Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you go to a wedding or a conference or something, you look at the table plan, you see, where are we sitting? And you hear another table, you know, where people are laughing. You think, oh, I wish I was on that table.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport, and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humor with you. Humorology is the study of how humor can dramatically improve every aspect of your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this very special edition of the Humorology Podcast is, in fact, my publisher, Mr. Peter Freeth. How are you?
I'm very good, Paul. Thank you for that beautiful introduction.
Well,
unlike your other guests, I'm not actually a celebrity, I guess, although I have been on TV.
Oh, well, I didn't know you'd been on TV. What TV was that?
You know, all these this proliferation of extra channels that we've got now that they have to stuff with some weird content. And you get these late night programmes that are, that they present as documentaries, but they're really just, you know, scandal sort of things. Well, I was in one of those. It was called The Dark Side of Stage Hypnosis.
Oh, my goodness. And what
TV production company that made, you know, scandalous expose type things.
What was your role in it?
Well, I was a participant on a training course where people were learning how to be stage hypnotists. And at the end of the 3-day course, we put on a public show in a hotel in London, and the TV crew filmed it as if it was a proper public show. But the angle that they were taking was, you know, look how easy it is for any idiot off the street to become a stage hypnotist and do untold damage to people's fragile minds. And so that was the theme of the whole thing that they were going for. And I met with the production company a few weeks before it, because I wanted to find out, what's the angle? What are they looking for here? You know, and they were saying, oh, it's just, you know, we just want to find out what it takes to become a stage hypnotist and so on. I thought, well, I don't believe that, because if you looked at their website, early in the days of websites, their other productions were things like the John Leslie scandal and Streakers 2. So I thought, well, I kind of know where this is going. And there were a lot of people on the course who were clinical hypnotherapists. And they dropped out of doing the show at the end because they didn't want people to see them in that kind of context. Whereas at that time, I didn't have that kind of concern about, a clinical professional reputation. So and I was in the bit where there's a very common thing you'll see in stage hypnosis, which is obviously a world that is very much on the edges of some of the things that your other guests have talked about, mm-hmm. around things like NLP and psychology and so on. And there's a very, very common part of an act that you'll see where the hypnotist does what's called a fast trance induction, where they'll push somebody's head back, they'll say sleep, and they'll just collapse on the floor, and everyone's really impressed. It's really amazing. But as with a lot of these things, there is a bit of trickery behind it, which is that you put your foot behind the subjects' feet so they can't step back. And when you push their head back, it's disorienting. And the natural reaction is to step back. They can't. So they fall over. And the idea is you catch them and you gently lay them down on the floor. And it looks very impressive. And they stay there because, you know, they're too embarrassed to do anything else, basically. And so they paired us up on the course. And I got paired up with this man mountain. And I just thought, there's absolutely no way I'm going to catch this guy. So when I pushed him on the head, I was behind him. So the idea is you shift your weight behind them. So you kind of catch them on your leg on the way down. I had no chance. The guy must have been about 20 stones. So he fell backwards. I kind of got caught behind him. I fell down. He fell down on top of me. We were both sprawling on the floor. And I saw the camera crew come running over. I thought, that's definitely going in the TV program. And it did. So that's my few seconds of fame there.
Well, I'm relieved it wasn't Crime Watch, to be honest with you.
It was pretty close. I mean, you know, some of the allegations they're making in the program about how hypnotists had sort of messed people up and so on. You know, there was some people who'd suffered some sort of serious stuff there, but I don't think any of it was because of the stage hypnosis. That just kind of opened the, you know, took the cork out of the bottle on something else that was happening.
Well, I'm intrigued because one of the reasons that you are the perfect publisher for me is because you understand so much about the psychology, the NLP, and all the background that I talk about. So, and it's very few publishers who have a background in that and actually can understand it. So when I send something into you, you don't go, what does this mean? You actually add to it and develop it. So just tell us a little bit more about your background what you've done in the world before you were a huge publisher.
Well, my working life originally started just over 37 years ago, 1985. I was a telecoms and IT engineer, then designer, designed bits of what today we call the internet, and in various countries around the world. From that went on to, I became less and less interested in the technology and more interested in the people and the sort of business applications and so on. So I started my own business back in 2002, well, 2000 really. I'd started writing, so I'd started getting into NLP training as a sort of an aside to my day job in the telecoms industry. I just started doing my own thing, and publishing was part of that. So it was partly consulting with companies and helping to develop teams and leaders and team performance. And then publishing was a natural fit for that because, you know, books are still today a fabulous way of encapsulating and presenting knowledge. And one of the things that you do and that I've done is we create knowledge. It's very easy to think of a corporate trainer as somebody who's an expert in something and they're just unloading that information into the audience, but that's not the case at all. And certainly when your style is more facilitative and when you're talking about a subject like leadership or sales or personal performance, there are no black and white answers. There is no one way of doing things. You know, you can go into any bookshop and see, you know, 100 books on leadership and they all say something totally different to the others. So if there's no one model, there's no one way of doing it. It must be about relationships. It must be about people. And that's what I got more interested in. So I started publishing books and writing books as well, inspired by some of the terrible books that I'd read on the subject. And I thought, I bet I could do better than that. So I had a go, and that's been it. And then, yeah, we got together in early 2009, it was.
Was it? God,
yeah,
that's
about 13 and a half years, yeah. The Pitching Bible, which is, you know, which I keep in pride of place on my, and that's a big book.
It is.
That is properly, you know, a big book. and a very good book as well.
Well, thank you, because we've stuck together basically because you are not only a brilliant publisher, and everybody at Genius Media Publishing is brilliant and supportive, but also I think the humour that we share is an important bonding part of it. Mm. And I'd like to just talk to our audience a little bit about how humorology came about, because I came and just so our audience knows, sometimes when I come and pitch an idea to Peter, you can tell when he's not keen. He's not necessarily kind either. You are quite blunt, and you go, it's a good idea or it's not a good idea. But when I pitched humorology, which for our listeners is, you know, we who just know the podcast, is now a book.
Here it is.
There you can go.
It's the real thing. It's a beautiful hardback book. You see, it isn't all empty space and filler. I think it's your best book, actually.
Oh, well, bless you. And you were so instrumental in it, because what was it, nearly 2 years ago now, you were the person who said to me, well, it's a great idea because it fits in with your background, with humour and with psychology. But if you're going to do it, you're going to need to get some interviews and interview people from business, sport and entertainment who understand this area. And actually, I just went, well, if I'm going to do that, I might as well do a podcast. So that's how the podcast started as well. Mm. But humorology, as we describe it, and I'd like to hear your description of it, is the art and science of using humor to create a competitive advantage. And I think we kind of agree that a sense of humor is your most important aspect in surviving and increasing in your breadth of reach in an increasingly complex world. What else do you think humorology is, and why is it important?
I think it's one of the humor is one of the interesting things that characterizes being human. And so I think if you look at any, if you look at any interview, read any autobiography, you know, people put funny stories in there. People tell a funny thing happened, you know, on the way to work today, a funny thing happened to me over the weekend. I think, as you said, there's that incredibly important bonding. There's lots and lots of research going back decades on humor as a really powerful way to increase resilience. And, you know, I remember reading research again decades ago that was about people who learn to see their misfortunes in life as a funny thing happened. They bounce back quicker, they recover quicker, and they recover stronger than the people who dwell in the victim mentality. And when I say victim mentality, it's something that happens to all of us. It's like, oh, this thing happened to me. Oh, what terrible luck I had. Oh, it's not fair. That's, you know, so I'm not talking about people who are, you know, wallowing in a pit of self-pity for years on end. I'm just talking about any time that we feel hard done by. And what happens when we get into that sort of victim way of thinking is that we give up our control. And always when you're talking about the sort of things that life throws at us, and these past few years, you know, we've had to cope with so much, and one of the most important ways that we do that is by taking control of events that we can't control. We can't control pandemics, we can't control what the government's doing and so on, and so one of the ways that we take control is by turning it into a joke, turning it into something funny that happened. And that could be through, you know, black humor, dark humor, through, you know, what do they used to call it?
Gallows humor.
Gallows humor, that's it. Yeah, thanks. There's nothing else I can do in this situation, so we may as well laugh. And laughter is uplifting. It's a social signal. It releases certain chemicals within your body that make you feel good. And it's a signal to other people that, you know, this situation isn't as bad as it seems. You know, and I think we've all been in situations at work where, you know, something really bad happens, like somebody makes a mistake and everyone sort of freezes and stops breathing for a moment until they see the boss laughs about it, and then everyone can relax again. So it's a real sort of cultural signal as well. So
I would say that it's also a social currency, isn't it? It's probably the easiest way to bond, and because it's a gift that's meant to be shared. Laughing together sort of means that we share values, we share life experiences, we share hopes and dreams, if you like. And that creates a connection that can last a lifetime.
And I've had experiences on holiday and being away on business, and I'm sure you have too, where I've exchanged, you know, I've shared maybe 3, 4, 5 words that are understandable between me and somebody else, but we still laugh. Yeah. You know, we'll point at something and we'll laugh or pull a funny face or whatever. It's like we hardly understand each other. But language becomes this, laughter becomes this common language between us. So I think you're absolutely right from that social bonding, social currency. And if you go to a wedding or a conference or something, you look at the table plan, you see, where are we sitting? And you hear another table, you know, where people are laughing, you think, oh, I wish I was on that table. I always seem to be on the table that wishes that we're on another table. Maybe it's a
table full of accountants. Yeah.
Well, and they're very, very charming people.
Yeah.
Lots of accountants listening. But yeah, we want to be around laughter. We want to be around people having fun. When we think back to childhood memories, friends who we've had for a lifetime, it's all people that we share humor with. So I think, and the application in humorology is obviously around improving performance in a business. And I think the connection there is, it's taking what we all intuitively know about humor, but it's putting some structure and backed up by some science into both how exactly humor translates through to performance of a person and a team and a business, but also then some practical ways that you, well, to put it bluntly, that you can be funnier, because you know, it takes work. It's not natural. It's something we're all born with, but the ability to tune that sense of humor, I think, to the context, to the culture, the organization, the place where we are, that takes a bit of work. And so that's in the book as well.
Yeah, well, and it's appropriateness, isn't it? Because whilst we say funnier, the Humorology project isn't just about being funny. It's about lightness of touch. It's about knowing humility, humanity, all those things as well. And I would say a very important word that you sort of touched on there was attitude. And the Americans have this saying that your attitude dictates your altitude. And I kind of like that whole thing, because something bad happens to somebody, their whole attitude can change the way. Now, can you find a way to see the funny side of it? That's an attitude. That's looking for something. You know, I'm just reading a book that the comedian Mark Thomas gave to me, by a firefighter, and they're constantly going out and they're having to see the most horrendous things, and the attitude is first of all of, you know, how can we get out of this state? And I think what laughter it does is it shifts the state. It may be the quickest way to shift the state. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think for them, again, they're dealing with these horrible situations that none of us would want to be in, that they don't have any control over. And they can either internalize that and take it home and it destroys them, or they've got to find a way to release it. And, you know, and laughter is a healthy way of releasing it, perhaps the healthiest way, because, you know, alternative ways of releasing stress are available, but they all tend to be addictive or harmful in some way. So I think you know, laughter and that shared experience of, you know, you've worked in comedy clubs, and I've been to a lot of comedy clubs over the years. Unfortunately, for some reason, not as popular today as they were back in the 80s, 90s, and or not as many of them around. But again, there was a real sense of people going to those sorts of venues to release stress, to laugh off all the day's hassle and worry and fear. Because obviously starting in the 80s, when we had this new wave of political comedy, what did they call it?
Alternative comedy.
Alternative comedy, right. Because yes. It wasn't just, oh, you ever seen my mother-in-law? She got two postcodes. You know, it wasn't that sort of humor. It went from that to, satire, talking about politics, giving people a way of laughing at the stress of, you know, through the 80s and 90s, a political environment that they couldn't control, they weren't happy about, but at least they could laugh. And, you know, and that was a much healthier way of releasing that, I think.
Yeah, I think it, and healthy is the main thing about it, is how do you have a healthy company? Well, a healthy company is whereby people feel relaxed enough. We've had a lot of, we've got a lot of quotes in the book from people in creative industries. And they say that without that ability to laugh and the freedom to laugh, they're really, it stifles creativity. It stops it happening. And so I think it's incumbent on companies and people who want to grow organizations to understand that it has to be there as a baseline for the company. And what do you think? Do you think that's always led by the leadership, or can it be ground up as well?
I think it can be ground up. I think people will look, you know, as I said earlier, people will look to the leader, to the boss, to see what they're laughing at. So it can be encouraged by the leadership of a company. It doesn't have to come top down, but it can certainly, they can certainly create space for it, and they can certainly encourage it. And it reminds me of a point you made earlier about times when I'd give you feedback on ideas that you were having for books and ideas to go in books. And I think it's really important that, and you talk about creativity, that a lot of people feel under pressure in organizations to do the right thing, to have a good strategy, to have the right plan, and to have good ideas. And all of that's complete rubbish. You have no idea, you know, my experience of people in global businesses all the way down to local businesses, nobody has any idea what they're doing, but they get lucky often enough. And then what human beings do is they'll congratulate themselves for their brilliant idea or planning, when actually it was just sheer luck most of the time. Or you hit a vein and you go with it and you see where it leads you. But, you know, I think that point about ideas, I think you've always had good ideas. It's whether they're aligned with where you currently are and the direction that you're going in. So no idea is a bad idea in itself. It's, is it going to work or not? And there have been things that you've wanted to shoehorn into other books that are great in themselves, but they don't belong in that book. They belong in a future as yet unwritten book. And I think for a lot of that stuff, that future book is now Humorology, because as you said, it was such a good fit for your credentials and your breadth of experience in comedy, and the people that you've interacted with in that world, and then the business world and the psychology aspect of it. So, you know, it was a perfect home for all of those. And I think a book has a personality, and a company has a personality that we call culture. And I think humor is one way of testing that. You know, if you're a friend of mine just had a job interview last week, and he actually said, and I'm going to find the text and read you. He thought the interview didn't go very well. He said, had the call and not feeling positive about next step. They were very rigid and formulaic in their approach, and not a bundle of laughs either.
Mm.
So he's using laughter as a test of the culture. If they laugh with me, then, okay, I can see myself here. I can fit in here. And if not, if they don't want to play along, then, you know, this is not for me, because his attitude is, look, you know, he goes to work to do a job. He's going to work hard. He's going to do a great job for them. But it's got to be fun. It's got to be enjoyable. So I think it's, I think laughter is a cultural test as well that we perform when we go into a new environment, start a new job. We see what people are laughing at and whether we like it or not, whether we feel that we fit in.
Well, that's really interesting, because sometimes on stage I talk about, I say, I put up a number which is 70.9%. And I said, what does that mean? And that's from an American study where they said 70.9% of people will change supplier based on one criteria. And that is if the new supplier is more fun. And people are always shocked in business. They go, that can't be true. But then I break it down and I start talking about, how do you behave? And your friend who just went for the job interview, what do you want? Do you want, I mean, it's not just about the wage packet. It's about how you feel going in every time. And so the Humorology project is really about getting people to understand what really is important to people. You know, when people are making decisions or at job interviews, which you're just talking about, what are they doing? Are they just looking at the CV and going, marvelous, they got a 2-1 from Oxford and they played rugby? No, they're getting a sense of the person. And a huge part of the sense of a person is their sense of humor, is it not?
And by the time you're at a job interview, you've already got the job on paper. They wouldn't be wasting their time talking to people who don't appear to have what they're looking for. And then the final test is, how are you interacting as a person? It's interesting that just in the last couple of weeks, there's a big recruitment website in the UK that started advertising on TV. I don't think they've done it before. And they've created this new differentiator. What they started out at was an aggregator of other job sites. And now they've created this unique differentiator, which is that they show an employer's happiness score.
Oh, wow.
They take feedback from people who work in companies. And so they, you know, when you see a job advert, you can also look up information on the company. There's been other websites around for years that have done this. But that's very much that cultural aspect of, okay, I could do this job. Let's say it's a web designer or software developer or something. There's 20 different companies. They're all in the same market, doing the same sort of work. They're all paying about the same. There's nothing to choose between them. So I think when you have a fair choice, then yeah, you're going to choose the one which is, where am I going to enjoy working? Where am I going to have a laugh every day? Where is it that fits with my personality? And that's going to be the same for the interviewer as well. They're going to say, well, we've seen half a dozen people. They can all do the job on paper. Which one do we want to have around more? And I've been through lots and lots of interviews over the years, both being interviewed myself, interviewing other people, working with HR teams, developing interview processes. And, you know, companies spend a fortune on trying to make interview process objective with psychometric testing and assessment centers and so on. And it's all a complete con, because at the end of the day, the hiring manager will just end up hiring the person who reminds them of themselves.
Yeah.
They will fiddle all that other data to make it fit the person they've already decided that they want.
And then the language patterns they all use are, he seems like a good fit. He seems like he fit into the general culture.
I can see her fitting in. Yes. I can see her. So they're imagining the future.
Yes.
So from an interview point of view, if you can fit yourself into that person's imagined picture, if you can make it easy for them to imagine you in that position, it's done deal, because, you know, yeah. I can imagine a nice big cake at lunchtime. if I can imagine it, I'm increasing the chances that that's actually going to happen.
Yeah,
I go to the sandwich shop, I think, well, I'll have a cake as well, because I've pictured it in my mind. It's become...
absolutely. And by the way, if you're leading with an element of fun, who doesn't want to be around that? Is there a single area of business that we can think of, or a working relationship, that isn't improved by fun and humour?
Yeah. And let's be clear, you're not going to get a job because you're fun, but you're a complete idiot and you have no qualifications. But it's all other things being equal. Then, yes. Yeah, absolutely. That will be.
Well, it's the competitive advantage part of humorology, isn't it? You know, and we say in the book that the average person spends, I think it's 3,500 days at work during their lifetime. Presumably, at some point, a sense of humour must come in handy on at least a few of those days.
You think, and you know, when I think back over my 37 years in work, what are the memories that stand out? They're the ones that are funny. They were either ridiculously funny at the time, or they were actually really horrible at the time. But telling the story of those events over the years, they become funny memories.
Yeah.
So all the things that I look back at, and maybe that's just me, but all the things I look back at from my working life, particularly the early days when I was an apprentice, they're all things that were funny, or things that I can tell as a funny story.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Yeah, and it's that social cohesion, isn't it? It's like, what does it say? It says we're in this together. We see things the same way. You know, that's what it is. And that's what bonds a company. And by the way, this is true of sports teams as well. You know, the teams that, you know, play well together, play well on the pitch together. All the, you know, people like Scott Cornell, who we've had in the book. And I also wrote a book with him, which you published, is Leader on the Pitch.
He's standing on a box there to make it look like he's taller than you in real life. He's actually a few inches shorter. I've seen the two of you side by side.
Exactly. But it's the magic of the media, isn't it?
Exactly. It's all a lie, isn't it?
You know, it's all a lie. I wanted to come on to some of the things, and we can ask these the same question of each other. But what makes you laugh, Peter?
I think just before you get onto that, there's a point I wanted to pick up on from what you were just saying about the bonding aspect, because there's some interviews in the book that echo the same theme about laughing together. And there's actually some research that you've cited in the book as well, and the phrase that the summary was, I think, the laughter only works if you laugh together. So because an aspect of this social bonding is we can't bond with 7 billion people and have close relationships. So we'll tend to have close relationships with a few people and have this sense of who's inside and who's outside. And if you think, you know, back thousands of years, that was a very tribal thing, wasn't it? Recognizing an outsider as a potential threat, but, you know, also an opportunity to trade or you know, whatever. And so talk about social bonding implicitly also talks about social exclusion. And I think one of the things to be really, really careful of with humor, especially in organizations, is we don't make the joke at the expense of the new guy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the old, you know, when I was an apprentice, you know, the jokes were sending the apprentice to the stores for a long stand, mm-hmm. or a new bubble for the spirit level or whatever. Yes. And that never happened to me, luckily. But I heard really horrible stories for apprentices in other companies about things that had happened to them that bordered on abusive. But it's all, you know, if you laugh about it, then you're one of us now. So it's like
initiation ceremony.
Yes, it's an initiation ceremony, absolutely. But it's laughter at somebody else's expense. And I mentioned earlier the stage hypnosis show. And so in the course, we were given this book of routines to follow. And they were like milking cows, bus trip to the seaside. Everybody thinks they're a chicken, seats on fire. This old, old formulaic stuff. And the thing that I liked about the course was the sort of way of tapping into the potential of the mind. What I didn't like was it was based around this old philosophy of treating the person on stage like they're a puppet. And you're just giving them instructions and the audience doesn't know you're giving them instructions. So they think they're acting of their own free will under in a trance, but they're not. And so we put on this public show at the end. And I was part of this four-person routine with these. So basically the TV crew wanted to focus on the sleaziest, weirdest, most horrible people who got a little slot of their own. And performed exactly as the TV crew wanted them to. It was perfect. And then the rest of us, we did this kind of tag team routine. So we got four people up and all of us worked with these four people doing separate routines. And I decided to improvise a routine. So I wrote a loose structure because the idea I had was that I didn't want the people on stage to be puppets. I wanted them to be part of the joke. I wanted them to be part of creating what was funny about it and for them to have a sense of being included in that. Not me just treating them like they're puppets. Literally up until 2 minutes before we went on stage, the other guys were still trying to talk me out of doing it because it was unpredictable and uncontrollable. And I liked that. I like unpredictable. I like surprise. And they didn't. They wanted me to do milking cows, bus trip to the seaside and so on. And I stuck to my, you know, because I thought this is my one chance to do this. And I'm not going to do what you want me to do on my one chance. And if it goes wrong, then it's my fault. It's not going to make any difference to you if it goes wrong. Yeah. So I did the improvised routine. And it was Who Wants to Be a Millionaire routine. So I had four people up on stage. And all I did was give them one simple instruction each and then ask them questions where I could control whether they got the answer right or not. There was some ambiguity. So I could keep on delaying the payoff at the end. And the instructions were, the first guy knew the answer, but couldn't say it. A woman next to him would always give a wrong answer, even though she knew the right answer. The third guy was a world expert on every subject and knew the right answer to everything. And the fourth guy, and this was at the time when the cheating scandal was going on.
Oh, yeah.
So the fourth guy would just cough every time one of the other contestants answered. And what really shocked me was how the four people on stage played out the instructions and were surprised themselves and how literally they took the instructions. So the first guy, he won't be able to speak the answer. He was trying to force his mouth open to get the words out and couldn't. But any other time other than answering, he could talk. Mm-hmm. So he took that very literally. The woman that would always get it wrong, would give the, you know, the opposite answer or the wrong answer. She'd say the answer. And then the surprise that she experienced, she was shocked to hear that come out of her mouth. What was in her brain wouldn't come out of her mouth. Something else was. And then the pompous know-all guy and then the guy at the end just coughed all the time. It was perfect. But I have this idea in what was said to the TV crew. Again, about not wanting them to be puppets. I want them to be part of the joke. I want them to benefit from it. Because if what we're doing is we're saying the human mind is so powerful that you could be in a function room somewhere. I mean, for them, for, you know, there's an audience, it's dark, there's a TV crew. So imagining that they're on a TV quiz show is not a huge stretch of the imagination. So I, you know, use that to as part of building the imaginary environment for them, really. But if you think that the power of the human mind is such that you could be in a room above a pub and actually think you're a chicken, or actually think you're a spy, or you're on a bus trip to the seaside, then you could imagine anything that you want to be true about yourself. And goodness me, if we're gonna demonstrate, and the way around that we were taught to get around the 1956 Stage Hypnosis Act was to say it's a demonstration of the potential of the mind, it's not a stage hypnosis show. Well, if that's what we're doing, then wouldn't we demonstrate it in such a way that the person actually gets something really amazing from it?
Well, with that, yeah, but that's then we get into the whole world of, you know, what are you anchoring in your own mind? Are you anchoring good feelings, or you're anchoring bad feelings? And that is essential to the whole humorology project, because exactly. The whole book is about how can you anchor or keep good feelings and lose the bad ones.
Yeah, exactly. Really,
because
no matter what is going on outside, and so whether it's ignoring the audience and pretending you're a spy, or ignoring what the government's up to and pretend, you know, and being happy in what you're doing, it's a very similar concept, I think. And so the TV production company, I told them about this idea, and they're like, oh yeah, that sounds really interesting. Yeah, couldn't you just abuse somebody and tell them that they're a chicken? You know, that's what they wanted, so they were not interested. So I ended the show by getting them, by telling them it was a draw, they'd all won, and they could imagine it winning their most, the wonderful thing that they'd ever, you know, thought of, that they most desired, forgetting that they'd taken the instructions very seriously. So the woman who always got the answer wrong, she could have anything that she wanted, her star prize was a pebble. She said it. Again, complete surprise. The guy who couldn't say anything. It kind of, you know, it didn't exactly have the heartwarming payoff that I was hoping for, because they were still acting out those instructions. But the thought was there. And then, would you believe it, years later, Derren Brown started doing the exact same thing that I'd. So obviously, you know, he had spies in the audience, stole the idea, or probably telepathically stole the idea from me.
Well, Derren's manager, Michael Vine, is a big fan of the show. So I think he might sue.
Tell him I want my at least a signed autograph of something. I've got a few of his books here.
I'll get you a signed autograph of Michael Vine.
But I think, I think it says that the idea comes of a time. And, you know, I had the idea back in about 2002-2003. I'm sure he did as well. But, you know, he's on a routine doing what he's doing. So it just seems to be an obvious idea. If we're doing something that demonstrates the power of the mind, let's use it to empower people and do something good for people and something meaningful and something wonderful. And I think that's another theme that runs through humorology.
Yeah. That
it isn't making jokes at other people's expense. It isn't inside humor. It's inclusive humor. It's collaborative humor. It's culture building humor, and it's bringing people together in a way that allows people to set aside the distractions and the ups and downs of life, and actually do something wonderful if that's what they turn their minds to.
Well, and aren't we all drawn to laughter? I just think that one of the points of humorology is to actually start pointing people at ways that they can see the funny side more. And I mean I know you do it in your life as well, and I do it in mine, whereby you make appointments for laughter. And that could be a TV show, it could be a film, it could be, but actually it's people for me is more important, you know. He's a great mate, and he's in the book, and he's on the podcast, Ainsley Harriott. We've been mates since school. And we can laugh at anything. We can just sit there and giggle, and we can do the same jokes again, and it makes us laugh. Most Mondays, we have a thing called the GBC, the Great Blokes Club, ironically. And it's just mates. But we know that we will go to a pub and we will just laugh our socks off. And it's like a 3-hour blood transfusion where you come out elated, you know, and, you know, it. And that's why people have to build in these things. You can't just wait for them to happen. Your attitude has to also change and go out and seek these things. And one of the most important things is that if your attitude is right, if you have the attitude of gratitude or the attitude of humor or attitude of humorology, you're going out with the attitude where you are willing to play, where you're willing to. And, you know, we know from psychology that if you want anyone to go into any state, you have to go into that state first. And so humorology is about building that state as well, isn't it?
Definitely. And you know, if you're going to go to the cinema to see a funny film, you're going to have a laugh with that intention. If you're going out with friends that are fun to be around, you're going out with that intention. So focus on that. Make that the intention. You know, put on an old episode of Reginald Perrin that we've been rewatching recently, and it is funny. I'm putting it on with the intention of I want to watch something that's going to lift my spirits. Because a lot of stuff on TV doesn't. A lot of stuff on TV is about making me feel like I should be grateful for how bad my life is, because I can see other people's lives are worse. And that's not uplifting. So, you know, watch stuff that's uplifting. Be around people that's uplifting, whether it's books or an activity, whatever it is, but do something with the intention of laughing.
And I think diarize that. In, as well, because if you talk about intention, but sometimes the best intentions go awry. So, but if you've diarized it and go, no, this is my Monday night laugh club. This is my, running club where I'll run and then have coffee with people. It's diarized and you can do it. You know, sometimes you and I call each other and we will talk for 2 hours. And a lot of that is about laughter and lifting the spirits, which I think is crucial for everyone, not just in business, but in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry, I dragged you back to a point that you'd made about inclusivity and belonging. But you had just started to ask me what I found funny, I think.
Well, yes. So just so it's an edit point. So, Peter, what do you find funny?
Marx Brothers, Groucho Marx. I've got almost all of his books, which are very funny. Funny writing, Reginald Perrin, the two Ronnies. So I like clever wordplay. Would be the thing that I would be drawn to. And I'm a great admirer of, and again, this is something that you've mentioned in the book, I'm a great admirer of straight actors who've turned to humor, who aren't trying to compete with the writers. So let the writers be funny. And this is something Leslie Nielsen, I remember seeing in an interview with him, let the writer be funny and play it as if it's straight. And then the situation will make the audience laugh. That juxtaposition will make the audience laugh, will make the situation funny. So I admire that.
Yeah, I think that's so important. The key to it is comedy sometimes. I remember back in Morris Meyer and the Majors days, and for those people who remember that far back. But one of the things I said very early on is we would do dance routines, but we would do them like the Drifters, the Temptations, the Four Tops, all those kind of dance routines. And I said, the tighter we are and the more serious we are about getting it right, the funnier it is.
Yeah.
And so the three of us were different heights. But we were so tight. We would sometimes rehearse for 3 days for one routine, just so it was spot on. And because, and if we never broke out of the taking it very seriously, we in our heads for the audience thought we were the Four Tops and we were that cool. Mm-hmm. But that becomes funnier. So it is about understanding the way humor works for other people as well. You know, you're very good at doing droll. You know, saying something that is ludicrous or ridiculous, but in a very, very sincere way.
Right. That's very kind. Most people call it sarcasm, but
well, ask me who invented sarcasm.
Who invented sarcasm?
I did. That's a joke by Jackie Green in New York, who's the queen of New York PR. But she taught my son Sam that joke when he was 5. And he didn't understand what it meant, but he still does it today because it's funny. Is everyone funny, you think?
I think so. It doesn't mean I laugh at everybody. So what do you think? Do you think everybody's funny?
I still think that it's more a gift from God than it is.
Well, clearly for you it is. You are the chosen one.
Thank you very much. Send all donations to the Church of Paulology.
Church of Humorology.
Church of Humorology. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no. Now we're in trouble. Do you find yourself funny, Peter?
Yes. I briefly thought, is there a way to say this without sounding arrogant? And then decided there wasn't. But I do laugh at myself, and I do laugh at situations that I'm in, and I do tell myself jokes in the car, I suppose. And I think in some ways that's a rehearsal. Well, in a lot of ways it's a rehearsal, and then, you know, some get shared with other people, some don't.
Well, you just said you laugh at yourself. How important do you think it is to be able to laugh at yourself? In for anyone in business and in life, to have that facility to see themselves as ridiculous?
I think, it's tremendously important, because without that, I think you become detached from other people. And my rule of thumb is if it was happening to somebody else and it would be funny, then it's funny that it's happening to me. The fact that it's me or anybody makes no difference if the thing itself is funny. So I think if you'd laugh at somebody else doing whatever it is, but yourself, you're defensive about it, I think that's a sign of being detached from other people.
No, I agree. If I asked you to write a business case for humour, i.e. we've got to go and go to a business and say you need more humorology in your worldwide business, what would you include?
I would include a competitive analysis that shows that actually, despite the best efforts of their marketing people, they are on a par with their closest competitors. And therefore, the only thing that differentiates at the point of the buyer's decision is the relationship between the salesperson and the buyer. And humor will be the competitive advantage at that point of differentiation. That's what I would base it on.
I agree. I think it's, I mean, if we go back to basics, that people buy from people they like and trust. How do you get to that situation where you have that likability and trust? Mm. One of the easiest ways is through humorology, is to actually
put some research on this in the book, that they actually, you know, scientists actually compared what people would pay for something when a joke was involved in the offer versus when it wasn't. And they would pay, what was it, 18% more or something like
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah. It's a
And the line was, you know, and I'll, well, make this my final offer, and I'll throw in my pet frog.
Pet I think frog
was the quote from the research. But so there's research evidence that says using humor as a at that final stage as a point of differentiation makes a material difference.
Yeah, and the other research that's in the book is that shows leaders with even a meager sense of humor are viewed as 27% more motivating and admired more than those who don't use humor, and their teams are 15% more engaged and more than twice as likely to solve a creativity challenge.
Sounds like you've written a pretty good business case there, just with that that input.
Exactly. No, I'll be sending that one out to companies all over the world, and we'll be going in. Have you ever taken a joke too far and crossed the line?
This is a really interesting point in the book, isn't it? That I think a lot of people are, you know, afraid of, oh, I don't want to go too far, but you can't go too far without going too far. You can't, you know, you can't know where the line is until you cross it. You've got to be prepared to offend people. So, I think, definitely.
Well, no, and you have to learn. I was hosting many, many years ago. I was hosting a vets conference in Birmingham, near where you're based. I did what normally works with a healthy company is I took the piss out of the CEO. Gently, I thought, but he hated it. And he was obviously a little bit of a tyrant. And everybody turned to look to see if he was laughing, and he wasn't. And that just infected the whole of the room. And it taught me a good lesson that you need to sometimes get enough rapport with people before you do that. Because I just went out and did what I thought was a gentle insult, you know, went down completely like a cup of cold sick.
Yeah, so that's a culture that's not ready for satire.
No, it's not ready for satire. Peter, we've reached the time in the show which we like to call quick fire questions.
Okay.
Quick fire questions.
What book makes you laugh?
Groucho and Me by Groucho Marx. He can be so insulting and acerbic, but such a tremendous writer. And he tends to take a bit of a winding tour around sort of poking fun at a lot of other people. And then at the end of the chapter or the conclusion of the story, he ends up being the butt of the joke himself. So he sort of uses it as a way of kind of collecting up all of these interactions and experiences and then sort of pointing that spotlight at himself, which I think is a tremendous skill.
I love Groucho, and I think the book is tremendous, and I love Groucho's lines like, outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend, inside of a dog it's too dark to read. What film makes you laugh?
My all-time I have two all-time funniest films. First is A Night at the Opera.
Back to the Marx Brothers.
And the second is a more recent film that had Lee Evans in it. I think Lee Evans's best acting role in a film called Funny Bones.
Oh, yeah.
That had George Carl. And I think it was Arthur Smith in the book has mentioned George Carl as well as being a fantastic clown. And Freddie, what was his name?
Parrotface Davis?
Yeah, that's it. If it's a dreary, cold Sunday afternoon, that's the film I'll always put on.
What word makes you laugh?
Yeah. What word makes you laugh?
Bollocks. Bollocks is always funny. Do you remember that actually there was a court case when Virgin released the Sex Pistols album, Nevermind the Bollocks, and they had the Manchester Virgin shop had it all in the window, just Nevermind the Bollocks everywhere. On the news, they were outside the court after the case had finished, and they interviewed Johnny Rotten, and they went up, Mr. Rotten, what do you think about the verdict? And he went, bollocks is legal. Bollocks, bollocks, bollocks. It's funny. What is not funny? Is anything not funny? Is anything not funny to you particularly?
For me, sort of inauthentic humor I find not funny. So I talked before about, you know, people having to tell jokes that have been written for them by others. If they don't take ownership of that, if they don't internalize that, then they're just reading out somebody else's lines. So I find that inauthentic, disconnected humor, forced, I find that not funny at all. How about you?
I don't like prejudice, which I don't like. And I also don't like what used to be called punching down. And I think you touched on it earlier, but because that's when it becomes bullying, you know, when you're just punching at somebody and they can't really punch back. What sound makes you laugh?
Again, it's a situation thing. The chairs in CJ's office in Reginald Perrin.
Oh.
Which before CJ's kind of reawakening, it was just his joke at the expense of people coming into his office. But then after his kind of his epiphany, he then becomes part of the joke. And so it's funny for everybody then. So the chairs that make a sort of a raspberry noise whenever somebody sits down or gets up again. And it turns out that it's not accidental, that he actually deliberately orders chairs that make embarrassing noises when people sit down. So it's nice how these sort of layers of his character get revealed. So I think that noise.
No, I'm very simple because I actually the sound of children laughing just sets me off. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Ooh, that's a
because it's a big one from as my publisher. It's a very important answer that this.
It is. It's very important because I think both are equally important. But if I kind of look at it in the negative. Which one wouldn't I want to be seen without? And I think I think I would have to say humor. I think,
yeah,
rather than clever, I would have to say.
Well, my belief is that actually, in order to be funny, you have to be clever. Finally, Peter, desert island gags. You can only take one joke to a desert island. What is it?
It's funny that the main joke I remember is a joke that a guy at work told me when I was an apprentice that's so obscene I can't and so prejudiced I can't possibly repeat it here.
In the book, I talk about one of my favourite jokes, which is the Steve Martin gag, which is before you criticise a man, walk a mile in his shoes. That way, when you criticise him, you'll be a mile away and you'll have his shoes. that's my favorite. My favorite in the world. Peter Freeth, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on the Humorology podcast.
Paul Barros, thank you so much for being a wonderful author of this fabulous new book that everybody should go out and buy immediately, because it will, if nothing else, it will lift your spirits and brighten your day and make you a happier, more successful person, as if you could want any more than that.
Thank you. The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros, produced by David Rose, music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.